Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hey everybody, I'm Sammy Strutt, Head of Learning and Development for Bigger, and I'd like to welcome you back to the Continue to Learn Extra webinar series. Today, Carl Hansel is going to be hosting us, so I'm now going to hand over to him and I'm going to disappear into the background.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks, Sammy. Thank you for that. Hi everybody, and welcome. Welcome to Season 2, Continue to Learn Extra. Thanks for the introduction, Sammy. Today, we're joined by three illustrious Scotsmen. They are some of the biggest names in the industry, the most important influential names in the industry today. And I'm delighted that they've joined us and given us a look behind the scenes at this summer's European Tour UK Swing. So before we get started, a quick brief introduction to everybody. Eddie Adams, to my left, I don't know where he's on your screen, but Eddie Adams is Director of Agronomy at the European Tour. He was born and raised in St Andrews and he still lives there today. He began his career working at the Home of Golf under the watchful eye of the legendary Walter Woods. He worked his way up through the ranks and became head greenkeeper on the old course in 1993, delivering both the 1995 and the 2000 Open Championships. In 2004, he joined the European Tour as greenkeeping advisor and became director of agronomy in 2018, providing agronomic support to over 50 professional tournaments in a regular year, including the Ryder Cup. Jim McKenzie is director of golf courses and estates management at the Celtic Manor Collection. He's been greenkeeping for over 40 years, starting as an apprentice at Hags Castle in Glasgow, and working at both Corder and Renfrew before moving to Wentworth's West Course in 1990. He then moved to Celtic Manor in 1993 and delivered the Ryder Cup in 2010. Largely, it's a Ryder Cup that's remembered for its horrific weather, which is either spectacularly unfair on Jim and his team, or it's a testament to their incredible talent that actually the event could actually be completed. He was awarded an MBE for services to sport in recognition of his efforts. Jim is, special note to Jim, he's currently holidaying with fellow legendary Scotsman Chris Kennedy, formerly of Wentworth fame, and their better halves in the Lake District. So we're especially grateful for you joining us, Jim. And with the best weather today is Angus McLeod, who is Director of Golf Course and Estates at the Belfry Resort. Angus has been greenkeeping for 37 years, although, like Jim, he doesn't look like he's been that long. He began his career as a 15-year-old apprentice at Inverness before moving south to Newport and then Belton Woods before taking up his current post at the Belfry. Incredibly, I'm led to believe that this was his first European Tour event. So I'll be interested to see, we'll be interested to see how Angus found that entire experience. Now, this is the point in the webinar where I look at you guys and I say, is there anything I missed? Anything important? Don't see anybody waving. I think we've covered everything. Brilliant. Okay, fantastic. Thank you, gents, for joining us. Eddie, we'll come to you if that's okay first. As far as greenkeeping CVs go, present company accepted, yours is pretty much as good as it gets. Can you explain your role at the European Tour? What is a director of agronomy?
We provide agronomic support to venues throughout the globe that we cover, so basically from Ireland to as far afield as Hong Kong or Korea we've been working at, and as far south as Malaysia and Indonesia. So there's three of us on the team at the moment, and we kind of leapfrog each other. We work clubs quite closely. We come into venues such as Celtic Manor or the Belfry and offer them some guidance on modern day professional golf, give them support where needed. Sometimes on occasion we have to offer some more support because the club may not have the resource and the support and the staffing levels that they need to get themselves across a line for a tournament. We can also get involved with programmes. you know, from basic programs for greens maintenance programs to pretty extensive programs for builds. Graham McNiven, my colleague, is working quite closely with Marco Simoni just now for the Ryder Cup in Italy, the next home Ryder Cup. So he's been involved with that quite a lot recently, and we'll spend quite a lot of time there over the next couple of years. And I think it's like a kind of a bond with the course manager. I think we get on pretty well with him. Jim's worked closely with Graham in the past. I worked with a number of the guys on the UK swing before, and some new ones like Angus. So it's really to provide them with support and somebody to bounce ideas off, and just kind of sharpen up the game for the event. A lot of doubts get thrown into your mind when you get told 6 to 7 weeks out, you know, you've got a tournament. Angus and I had a long discussion on how we kind of did a schedule, and I think I gave Angus a bit of relief when I told him that you didn't have to have everything done in this particular order. We were quite happy to work within an environment where there was some noise in the background, because the players are used to hearing generators from some of the hospitality units that we normally have, or aircraft flying over, or motorways right next door, which Belfry had a motorway next door and they had aircraft flying over. So I think that puts your mind at rest, and then just providing support as and when required.
Right. So, well, it's an incredibly close relationship with them. So how did these guys react when you immediately after lockdown, or maybe it was even during it, I'm not sure the time scale on it, told each of these guys, hey, can we host an event at your spot in 2 months? What was the reaction?
Well, I don't have any doubt in my mind that the guys would react as professionally as possible. I mean, I knew that it would be challenged. They had the challenges more than we did, because they were working with lower levels of staff than they normally had. Some of the places weren't taking in any revenue. It's very difficult to get, you know, the core work that we would require for a tournament underway. So I think I came down to see Jim on the 10th of June or 9th of June or something like that. And Jim was just starting to pick up on staffing levels there, and similar with Angus. So I'm not sure how they kind of took the kind of challenge, but they all took it from our point of view very professionally, and delivered, well, 6 events that none of our guys walked off and criticised. You know, all our guys were delighted to be playing golf and returning to playing golf, but the conditioning of the golf courses were fantastic. And considering the pressures put on everybody, travel, getting access to materials, things like that, were pretty brutal. So I think, you know, from Brian up at Newcastle right through to Hanbury Manor, down to the Forest of Arden and Belfry, and finishing up, well, further south, Celtic Manor, they think all the guys stood up. And very different golf courses, very different environments. So it was quite a challenge for all of them.
Yeah. Just for reference, how much notice does a golf course generally have that a tournament's coming its way?
Yeah, I mean, say probably on average, they probably know they're going to host an event a year to 2 years out. Yeah. There's always the fastball, but then again, Jim knew he was holding the Ryder Cup many years before that. So,
absolutely.
So there is, and Wentworth knows it's going to have an annual event. You know, that's pretty well stitched onto our schedule. So, generally speaking, I'd say 9 to 12 months. Our schedule is very kind of fluid at the moment, so, but we've got ones that we know we'll be going back to. So it's a building up of a relationship there, which is key. That's for me is the key thing. It's being open and honest and objective with the view on the golf course, and getting the team on side, and you know, a bit of camaraderie and a bit of banter didn't harm anybody from our point of view. So,
and
we tend to push, you know, just that little bit more. I think that's because sometimes it's needed, and sometimes it's just a test, and sometimes the guys rise to it, and some guys sometimes don't. But none of the guys let themselves down, or their companies down, or their clubs down at all during this UK Championship. It was good to be involved with it.
Brilliant. Jim, it was 6 years since your last European Tour event. I'm sure you were looking forward to a few quiet years after the excitement, but that wasn't to be the case. You spoke to Golf Magic a month or so ago, and you said it would be a race against time, probably longer than a month now, a race against time to get the place in order for an event. Did that end up being the case? Was it tricky to get it up to standard?
I would say so, Cal. Like everyone else, we had the wettest winter on record. We also had the record number of rainfall days in the winter. We didn't have an opportunity to do any spring maintenance. We had a lot of bunker reconstruction going on. As an example, we had four or five bunkers in the process had been filled in. We had no bunkers on the sixth hole. We had no tees on the 15th. We were going through quite a regeneration program when the word came that we had to lock down, and we maintained the golf course for effectively 3 months with three people. We maintained our Roman Road course with two people and our Montgomery course with one greenkeeper and a gardener. As I've said a few times, when you starve a facility of its revenue, you also starve it of its ability to spend money. So it really was a difficult time. A few people have said, two events 2 weeks in a row, that must have been unusual. But when we first started talking to the tour back at the beginning of May, we were talking about four events in a 3 week period, believe it or not. We were talking about starting one event on the Thursday, finishing it on the Sunday, starting the next one on the Tuesday, finishing it on the Friday, starting the next one on the Sunday and finishing on the Wednesday. So just to have two was a bit of a
Wow. How did you did those four events not happen because you said don't be daft, or what happened there?
No, I mean, that was just in the early days before the reached out to all the other venues. So it was the fishing period, if you like.
Yeah. Could you have done it? Would you have been confident in doing that?
I wouldn't have been happy. I mean, there was a number of things to take into consideration. Obviously, yeah. It started earlier in the year. We were more than happy with when our first event started. We weren't able to, for economical reasons, we weren't able to take on our usual summer staff. We had the best part of half a dozen people across the golf department, the greens department, who had left and were due to be replaced that weren't replaced. So, we were really struggling for numbers. And I think the way that that we work, where the guys work every second weekend with two events, it meant the guys worked five weekends in a row. And for something like 22 days, they worked from 4 o'clock in the morning to 9 o'clock at night. So it was approximately 110 hours a week for 3 weeks. Could we have done more? I doubt it.
Wow. Okay, you're the expert. You're the experienced guy on the panel when it comes to hosting events like this. When Eddie comes to you, or whenever the announcement is made that you're going to host two events, what do you practically, literally, what do you do as the leader of that team to say this is going to be a success? What's the first thing you do?
Well, obviously, we had to get the guys to buy into it. First of all, like you quite rightly say, it was 2014 since we did our last full tour event. We've done a couple of seniors ones since then. But our staff has changed quite a bit in that time. Mm-hmm. 2014, we estimated that 90 to 95% of our full-time crew had done an event before. This time, we estimated somewhere in the region of only 20% of the crew had done an event before. So we had to get these guys on site, first of all. We had to be quite upfront in terms of how hard they would have to work before, during, and strange enough, just after the event. So that was probably the main thing. The rest of it was all agronomic and rebuilding bunkers and rebuilding tees. And we certainly called upon the guys' ability to finish these tasks. It really was a race against time.
Yeah. Well, is it as simple as, do you have a checklist maybe in a folder in your office where that you must tick every box to work down, you know, in tournament preparation? Is it as simple as that, or is it more intuition?
Well, strangely enough, you know, up until this UK swing, we had held 15 Wales Opens between 2014 and between 2000 and 2014, and every single one of them was different in quite a number of ways. And so, you know, we have got a list of things that we learned from previous events, and it's not just on the golf course things. It's, you know, how do you treat that number of staff that work in these hours? Where do you feed them? When do you feed them? What their welfare facilities are like, how they get into the site, as an example, how they get out the site. So there are some things that are fairly generic across the events, but each event, you know, has a specific problem. Of course, this year, one of the big differences was the COVID situation, the fact that we had effectively, we were working bubbles. You know, myself and some of the guys had to be COVID tested multiple times over the two week events. The rest of the guys were accredited, and then, like Angus, would have got texts at 4 o'clock each morning asking you to fill out a health check. And you know, if you filled that out wrongly or didn't fill it in, your accreditation in that day wouldn't allow you onto site. So there were a lot of things that were very, very unusual this year. And next year, if we host one again, there'll be a different set of circumstances. So yeah, it's a bit of both, really.
Yeah, we absolutely have to talk about the COVID restrictions going forward. I'm just going to nip to Angus, if that's okay. In contrast, Angus, we mentioned that this was your first European Tour event. We obviously, the Belfries have been talked about having events again for years now. And it's great that the European Tour was able to return. Without that expertise and that experience and level head of Jim, what was your reaction when you got the news that you were going to be hosting an event?
Huge trepidation, as you can imagine. I think we were talking in May for an event coming back to Belfry. We were super stoked and super excited to host. In 12 years, really, since anything happened in Belfry. And I think that we were kind of more excited for the new crop of players coming that have probably never set foot at the Belfry, you know, and probably seen it from past historic and iconic homes, etc. But so we were, when we discussed it, I mean, there was only three of us. I mean, I met Eddie at the Belfry by coffee. I gave him a Starbucks. That was just our first introduction to the Belfry. We walked the course, and it was like Jim, you know, through COVID and lockdown, it was only myself and the other one mechanic and two assistants that ably were running the whole resort for best part of, you know, nearly 2 months. So, you know, and then to get the call saying that we're looking at hosting the event, and you know, like, our list is, you know, twice as big as Jim's on, you know, what we need to get right. But thankfully, you know, with Eddie's experience at ease, that we weren't in that bad a shape, really. We just had to fine tune it. We offer a Ryder Cup experience every day here at the Belfry, because it's their day, it's their Ryder Cup. So, you know, from tournament conditions, yes, there's 30-40% in the tank where you can, you know, raise the standard, raise the bar, but that takes staff and levels, and we just didn't have them at that time. So it was so exciting. You know, I've been involved in tournaments with Jim at the Wales Open, and thankfully I've been fortunate enough to do the Ryder Cup with Jim. You know, so I've been around tournaments, but actually leading it, you doubt you kind of question your, you know, your knowledge, you question your ability, you question the strategy, you question your logistics. But it all sort of comes, you know, and again, with the support that we had from the European Tour, it was, you know, we had some of Jim's second week. You know, we had a wait start to the tournament, and I think we learned more, and we learned more from the team, and you know, than we would have done had it been a dry week. It had been, you know, fairly repetitive. The boys would know what we're doing, but that helped us kind of learn from that experience.
It sounds like you, essential maintenance was so basic. You guys who have kept it, the work that you were able to do was so limited. To have gone from that to a tournament quality standards just stands to the talent of your teams. Eddie, were you expecting to arrive at these spots, perhaps thinking they might be a little bit less rough around the edges, you know? Did you warn the players it might not be up to the standard they expect?
No, we did not. I think from the get-go, from the initial visit to the actual event, there's a pretty constant level of communication, whether it's with Jim with Graham or myself with Angus or Stan or Brian and Eugene did it Forest of Arden with Rob. There's a constant stream of, you know, updates and any questions. And from what I'd seen, I think the battle they had was more the weather. I mean, Stan had a tough time at Hanbury Manor. He was, yeah, I think it was 37 Celsius the week before, and still with golf. So it was quite tough, but produced a great golf course as well. Very different, firm, fast fairways, and greens were great as well. No issues there. But from our perspective, I hope the support we give was, if weekly or every couple of days, and updates. And the guys know, they'll flag it, you know, if there's issues. And we also have pretty other guys going on to the ground as well from our team, whether it's somebody going in to look at how they stage the COVID testing, for example, or where the TV goes into where, you know, so we've always got, you know, some sort of communication going on between the clubs and the tour. So, no, I, to be honest with you, I'm not saying this because I'm on this. It was refreshing, but I think I didn't expect any less of the guys that were kind of dealing with, you know. So and just so Belfry was very interesting for me because they had a huge amount of play. I mean, it was very, very busy as well, which is another thing you've got to take into account. I think, I mean, the week before the tournament, we had, I don't know, 200 players on the Brabazon and 200 players on the Derby and 200 players, and it was very busy, and it's difficult to get work done, but Angus managed to get it done, and they're used to that. That's their environment, you know. So each of the venues are unique in their approach, but still got to the end result, which is what we needed, and it worked out quite a treat for us.
Brilliant. Let's go talk about the COVID restrictions that you guys put in place. Can you maybe give me an indication of how you had to adapt your work purpose, you know, your work practices to match up, keep everybody safe? Probably start with you, Jim. What sort of restrictions did you put in place?
Well, I mean, obviously, we had, as soon as lockdown, well, before lockdown, you know, as a major 400 bedroom hotel resort, where we can have more people on site in an average day than a local Welsh village can have. Obviously, we put together quite stringent protocol before lockdown happened, right from the staff coming to work in the morning, you know, how they work, how they access buildings, equipment, etc., etc. So I think we had a fairly robust set of protocols in place right from the beginning, and we're quite fortunate being a large employer. We employ 977 full-time people, and one of them obviously is a very a sort of well qualified health and safety compliance officer, and she has people working with her as well. So we as a resort had this in place very early. I think when the tour guys started to arrive, I mean, the day Eddie arrived, as an example, for a quick look when he did his drive around the venues, I mean, Eddie and I go back, you know, what is it, Eddie, 30 odd years or whatever?
Yeah.
We didn't shake hands, you know, we didn't share a golf buggy, you know, things like that. You know, we sat and had a cup of coffee, you know, two metres plus away from each other. So right from the beginning, all the way through to when the actual event happened, the protocols were fairly rigid. And I have to say, the, you know, the set of protocols that the European Tour and their COVID compliance partners had put in place was very impressive indeed.
Brilliant. Angus, how did you know, find that the restrictions, you know, were they limiting, or did it have no impact on what you're able to achieve?
Yeah, I think probably just at gym. You know, we were ingrained in that from the get-go. Being a big business, like we were 704 odd employees, and you know, keeping them safe was obviously was key, and following the guidelines and the safe guidelines. So, you know, when the tour came on, we wanted to show the tour that we were actually really compliant in a lot of the safety measures. So there wasn't a lot that people have to be too worried about. Obviously, they were going to bring their own measures in, but our guidelines were similar to gyms. And our company insisted that we would get tested as well as European testing. And so we still had the same COVID where the team came in, they get tested at security before they can come to work, changing the clothing, etc. So, and then having to change it to work well when they get down the yard. So all these like extra, you know, 5-10 minutes into your working day and each of your setup. But that's the guidelines, that's how we're following, that's how we're keeping everything safe, that's how we're keeping people's jobs safe. And primarily we have an outbreak at the hotel. The consequences are huge for everybody. Golf at the moment is the main driver. That's our main revenue driver. So it's a lot of the other parts of the business aren't delivered at the moment, and you know, fault of their own. They just have no confidence yet. But golf is confident, and like Eddie says, we're busy. You know, we get baggies, and the baggies have to be cleaned down, and they have to be wiped down, and they have to be sterilized. The flags have to be sterilized every day, team markers, et cetera, et cetera. And then part of the working schedule for the team as well. All the safety measures down in our yard. You know, so there's extra, all these additional things where you haven't got a full influx of your staff yet. It just adds to the additional resources that are very, very tight. So it's a challenge. It's become the new norm. We're kind of used to it now. Staff kind of whined and moaned about having to get changed and out-changed and et cetera. But, you know, we reiterate that, you know, if we don't follow these guidelines in place, then, you know, the consequences are. So they get it. But it's this isn't going away. So we have to live with it for the time being.
Yeah, brilliant. And to my knowledge, golf has had there aren't any courses where we've seen centres of, you know, outbreaks or anything like that. So it seems that the efforts that you guys are doing to protect your staff and to protect your players, they seem to be working. And that's actually rubbing off the, you know, golf seen now as a safe sport to do, and numbers are up. So long may that continue. When you've mentioned a couple of times that you were busy in the build up to the events now, did you ever have a conversation, Angus, with your management and say, you know, can we reduce the tee times, make the course look a bit better, or was that just not something that was going to happen?
Yeah, that was going to be a tough one, given the fact there's no generator. Like Eddie says, the place was pumped. I mean, we were numbers that we haven't seen before. I mean, record numbers we've been getting in golf. And my respite was 4 o'clock on Sunday prior to the professionals turn up on Monday morning. My only concession was that I managed to get buggies off the week before, and that helped from the high traffic routes. The Brabazon, and you know, it's 40 years, she's only 151 acres, which is not a big site. So to take that volume of play and not volume of traffic, my main concern was the golf course going to look tired on the TV if we had a wet run up to the tournament. Thankfully, we had 1 millimeter of rain the whole of August, which posed problems with turf quality and density. And you know, Eddie coming in, and we're trying to get definition, and I couldn't deliver definition. And then, thankfully, kind of 10 days out, we managed to get a little bit of rain, that just lifted the old girl up. And then we got a bit of colour, we got a bit of grass. We put all the materials down with hopefully that we would get rain. The non-irrigated areas that we couldn't control. And thankfully it came, and we managed to get some definition, a little bit of kind of consistency in the roughs, and that was our primary concern. I was never going to get any tee time reduced, that's for sure. It was never going to happen.
Well, you've mentioned rain, and both of you guys had bad weather as it happened, which is probably why the UK swings a rarity these days. We had rain. There wasn't the ideal conditions for them. You had Storm Laura come through Angus. You rained yourself for Jim. After you've done all that, you bust a gut to prepare to get the course as you want it to be. You know, you've worked 120 hours, I think it was, Jim, and it rains. Like, what do you do? How does your team just deflate? And how do you get them back up or are they running on adrenaline anyway and it's just another challenge? What happens there?
Well, I would say that they're certainly running on adrenaline, but golf's an outdoor sport, and weather's just another vagrancy of the outdoor sport. You know, we do have very, very strong protocols in place for bad weather. You know, we have a whole load of squeegees on site. We're quite fortunate where our maintenance facility is, so we're able to get to the golf course, get to most of the greens fairly easy. But for us, as an example, we didn't cut the fairways on the night before the first event because the temperature was over 30 degrees and we had to keep the buggies off the fairways because they were marking the fairways. That was on the Wednesday night. And then on the Sunday of the first event, when there was only 24 guys left in the golf course, we had to take them off due to thunder lightning. And while they were off, we had extraordinary rainfall. And then for the second event, it was just fairly damp and miserable for the whole week, quite frankly. It rained quite heavily on the Wednesday. And then for us, the big problem was on the Saturday morning. And we had a 6:30 tee off time on the Saturday morning, so it wasn't daylight till about 20:06. And the heavens opened just as the first game set foot off the putting green to walk towards the first tee. And by that stage, as Eddie and Angus will be well aware of, most of the staff are in the wrong place. They don't have necessarily have the right equipment with them. It's the worst possible time to have bad weather. So, you know, fortunately, the guys were able to rally and get back. But, you know, again, it's one of these things. If you're not prepared to deal with the weather, then, you know, you shouldn't be in the job, really.
You say there about your team rallying, the running on adrenaline. How do you know, and is it something that you can spot when they walk in, or is it something that you develop? How do you know that a guy is going to be someone who rises to the occasion, that gets up there? How do you spot that talent? Do you see it when they walk through the door in their job application? What is it that distinguishes the guys that you want, who you know are going to rise to the occasion, and the ones that you maybe pass on?
Well, I think like Eddie and Angus, you know, we've interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people each, thousands of people between us, and I always feel you get a feeling for it within about the first 5 minutes. Within about the first 5 minutes, you know whether the guy's going to be a success or not. And it's not about his greenkeeping abilities, it's about his persona, his body language, how he comes across, his reaction to questions. And, you know, I think, you know, it's a job that you want to be in. It's not a job that you're forced to be in and then forced to come to terms with. Mm-hmm. And I think from that point of view, we're able to tell right away.
Eddie, we've mentioned you work at, you attend golf tournaments all over the world, 50 a year, all over the world. How do UK greenkeepers compare to those, you know, in different countries? Is there a difference? Are they the same? You know, what would you say?
I think there was a few years ago. I think if you work out in the regions like China, for example, which have done a lot of tournaments out there, they're pretty well technically good, competent greenkeepers, golf course superintendents, all well trained, all kind of tend to access the GCSAA programs, or they've gone through the Ohio State. There's a lot of guys that have done that. On the continent, France have started to pick up. A lot of good guys have been there for a long, long time, but they tended to come across from the States and Canada. I mean, I remember Steve Akula and Bill Warnock, he's still at San Norman Bateche. They've done some great work across there and good superintendents. But yeah, I'd say I wouldn't say there's a huge amount of difference. The difference is the staff in the UK events generally are all in some form of training, if you know what I mean, whether they're on level one or working through the ranks or higher than that. Where else, they're, if you go to somewhere like Malaysia, you might have 120 staff for 18 holes, and you might have five or six staff that have actually got any formal greenkeeping training. So it's generally working with contractors on golf courses like that. So some of the superintendents are producing in countries like Malaysia or Indonesia, Vietnam, Cambodia, that they're really top-end superintendents and very good at what they do. But lower down, there's room for better training programs and recognition for guys coming through the ranks. So it's quite a difficult dynamic out there. But on the continent, Germany, France, Spain's got a great education program. The federation's quite strong down there. Sweden, the federation's strong there as well. So the programs are pretty strong down throughout the continent. I've been to places far as flung as Kazakhstan. The guy wasn't a greenkeeper. He just liked golf and was so keen to learn and accepted advice and took. We do tournament guidelines, which are give them a kind of balanced look at how a golf course should be presented and what he requires, and it gives them a little help and direction. So yeah, I mean, as a core team, the UK greenkeepers, and similar to America as well. If you look at America, the GCSAA kind of look at four or five guys in their team. The rest are generally like operators, where our teams are, you know, generally going through some sort of formal education in the UK and Ireland. So there's always room for improvement, but I don't see a huge difference at the top end of superintendents. Yeah. You know, there's some good guys globally. In South Africa, I've got some good superintendents as well.
Yeah, well, I hope that having those layers and those lower down guys to be well trained means that if something does go wrong, such as the weather, that they're better equipped to cope. Would you agree? I mean, I hope that's the case.
Yeah, I think that it's down to kind of like Angus said, it would have been a boring week if Angus had fantastic weather. But I mean, it was a test in time. We did get, yeah, I think, Angus, about 42 millimeters of rain over 48 hours, and it's difficult when you've not had that situation. What do you do? How do you approach it? Jim's got experience at it. Angus may have experience getting water off a green because he's got punters paying money for it, but
yeah,
we have to have a referee at the green. Guys have to go and, you know, get asked, do you want this water cleaned, etc. And we're obviously down a little bit on refereeing as well, because it's difficult to get all the staff into the country as well. So I think we had six referees on site at the Belfry. So if we needed any more than six or seven squeegees, we were going to have to suspend. So but we did suspend on the 10th green, because the 10th green put us under for a couple hours. But can I just, on the back of that, there's a we cut the fairways the next morning, didn't we, Angus? The fairway drainage on Belfry was phenomenal. So we got into the golf course and raised it back up to the standard that was expected for the next morning, you know. So it was good.
Angus, this was your first European Tour event, and the weather wasn't perfect. Did the experience live up to, you know, what you expected? Was it better? Was it worse? Are you glad for the challenge, or would you rather it was sunny that entire week?
I've gone grey. So
you were already grey.
No, because of Eddie, but it was a lifelong dream to be able to be in charge and run an event. And I was just super excited, you know, as soon as I heard. And then there was a rumor that we weren't on the list for the tournaments, and I was really deflated. But then we came in a swing, and then they talked about having the back to back, and I'm going, no, please, Jim, have the back to back. Give Jim four of them, and I'll have the other one, you know. Because I thought the two weeks on the Brabas and with pros that have got very little to do but hit balls, I don't think I've had much grass left. So, but yeah, it was really great to see the Brabs on the telly, and that was our focus, to get it back on the TV, to get it back in the worldwide audience, to get it, try and present it as well as we physically could with the numbers that we had, and obviously with the restrictions, everything. And like, you know, Jim was saying, you know, get materials and products in, and we got fantastic support, which is great, through the event. We keep the troops motivated because we're all our sponsors, you know, got pop and crisps and sweets and juice and tea, and Eddie was drinking tea the whole time. You know, so we keep them well lubricated. But and then, you know, on the Monday, it was like Jim was saying, the team were so up for it. That's what they come to the Celtic Manor, they come to, you know, the Forest of Ireland and all the European tour venues for tournament experience. And we haven't delivered it. And I felt bad for the team. And you know, the training program is great, and we educate the team, and then they go off and do their own thing, and it's great to see. And it gives me more satisfaction to see the lads and lassies that have come through the ranks and are running their own venues now, and that gives me so much satisfaction. But we never gave them tournament experience. You know, yeah. So, and you know, we lost a mechanic prior to the event. You know, he went off and did his own thing, so we got a new mechanic in. So a lot of structures that weren't in place, and we were like, you know, how are we going to cope? But the troops rallied round, and they were so motivated and so up for it. And then, you know, Monday, we could sleep on Monday, you know. Well, we couldn't because we didn't have the 220 golfers playing the Brab, so we couldn't. But it was yeah, we were, yeah, super excited. And you know, hopefully through that partnership with the European Tour, we can have another bat at it. I don't think, I mean, she was still a good test.
Yeah.
You know, even with technology now, she wasn't.
It was.
Eddie, what's the feeling? What's the general consensus around the European tour now? It rained, which isn't ideal. Is there a desire to, you know, we've talked about over the years how we've lost so many UK events in golf, and perhaps that's been seen as a reason that the sport's dropped off in, you know, popularity. Is there a desire to maybe keep some of these spots on the rota now for the coming years?
Well, I think there's been a lot of positive feedback from the membership. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there'll be some thoughts going into that going forward for next year's schedule. And I think everybody wants the third week in July as a date. Unfortunately, that's going to somewhere else. So it's difficult to get the date set into the schedule. But I think we'll be looking at doing something next year. And it depends on what we have or face with COVID, if it still restricts travel,
yeah,
and movement. So from our point of view, the Belfry was it's matured lovely over the last couple of decades, and it was a tough test. And I think to a man, you know, all the players liked to test off the tee, and it worked out quite well. And so much it was, I think, 14 under one at Angus, yeah. And it was quite well received by all parties. So I'd love to kind of do the kind of UK swing again, but I don't do the schedule. But I think sponsorship's key, obviously. We've got to try and get sponsors back in to help us out. And I'm sure it'd be great to have the Belfry and Celtic Manor and Forest and all the other venues we used back on the tour, but that's going to be dependent on what happens with the world over the next 6 months, I suppose. And we're pushing it. We're pushing it with events in October, November, you know, for tournaments, even in Spain, and we're going to Scotland for the Scottish Open, which is a completely new date. I mean, I worked at St Andrews, so I did a few Dunhills. The weather can be quite different there sometimes in October, albeit I dodged a few bullets there, but we've had frosts and we've had high winds, so, and then I think Fairmont's a couple of weeks later as well, so it'll present unique challenges then, you know. So, but all in all, I think, yeah, nice to see a return to the Belfry for and Celtic Manor and Forest of Arden, etc. for next year, but we'll see.
Brilliant. Jim, after the Ryder Cup, you hosted the Ryder Cup, and the crowds there are famous, you know, just the noise. Then hosting an event with no spectators there, was that weird? Was that eerie?
It was eerie. I think it was. It's incredible in your pre-tournament build-up how much time and effort and resources you have to put into the building of the tented village and the, you know, getting car parks ready and all the on-course catering and all the stuff that's associated with crowds. And of course, that was the first time we realised, you know, hey, this is going to be different. It was a little bit strange. I mean, as an example, one of the things that defines your golf course during a golf tournament is the crowds and the white posting ropes up either side of the fairway. It brings your whole envelope in. It makes it narrower, makes it more like a tournament golf course. That wasn't there. And of course, a player hits a good shot, you know, you don't hear any noise. You don't hear the on-course generators that Eddie was talking about earlier on. So there's none of that. And on a more practical level, one of the things that we had to be very careful was that, generally speaking, all the TV cables run along the crowd post and rope lines. And of course, there was no post and rope lines. So the potential for the staff to chop a fibre cable in half, as an example, was extremely high during these events. And I guess it was something that we were all having to pay particular attention to, because, you know, if you cut a fibre, the TV guys will, you know, tell you about the inflated cost of fixing a length of fibre. You're very unpopular.
Brilliant. Well, yeah, I imagine that is difficult for you. Angus, we saw you with a rake in your hand. Did you get stuck in throughout the event, or was that just a photo opportunity?
Probably a photo, yeah. Probably photoshopped from somewhere. I've normally got a divot bucket rather than a rake, so no. But actually, on the Friday morning, it was Friday morning, yeah. Myself and Mr. Eddie Adams here were raking the largest bunkers on the site, so we were leading the troops by example. So we had to get the bunkers back puffed up. And then raked again for the players. So there was a lot of that going on. The bunkers gave us our biggest challenge through the event. Because, you know, there's a lot of effort there. You got to push the sand back at the gate, contamination. We had bunker pumps going on the Thursday night, Thursday afternoon to get some play. We got some play back on the Thursday afternoon. So I think that was... We probably enjoyed that, even though we're probably why would you enjoy that? I think that we kind of learned more on what we require, what the tournament requires from the greenkeepers when the weather does go inclement. And that was a good learning experience for to be ready and to be organised and be available, you know, when called and keep play moving. And that's our job, is to, you know, my job primarily on a day-to-day basis is to keep the golf course open. So whether it's playing punters or European Tour players, it doesn't change. You know, we lose the revenue, we buggy income. So, but yeah, answer your question, yes, I did have a rake, and I was rake.
Well, you said one of your mottos for your team is to present a Ryder Cup experience every day for everybody that plays the course. Yeah. Did you, having now hosted an experience, an event, a tournament, are you confident that you were in the past? You know, or have you think, oh my God, there's so much more we need to do? And has your team benefited from that experience? You know, what's the benefit to a team of actually hosting events? Are they better as a result now, going in their day-to-day life?
Yeah, very much so. I think what we've really seen from the team is the confidence. You know, my senior guys, I mean, I've got a lot of youth in my nobody age, you know, must be, you know, like in the late 20s from my team. So, it's given confidence that we can deliver that with the resources we had available as well. We normally run this tournament, you know, with more staff than we currently have anyway. That was a challenge in itself. But we kind of learned a lot. We do push the envelope and standards in the golf courses and overall three, really. And we try and spread that resource wisely, so that, you know, because when it comes to the Belfry, it's a Belfry experience. It's not just about the Brabazon in PGN and Derby. So we get, you know, we get feedback and customer feedback to see what Jim does on his three venues, his three golf courses. So, but yeah, definitely the team are a lot more confident now, and they feel now that. And after when Eddie left, they went, you know, they've done tournaments, you know, around the world, but we learned a lot more. We thought we were tournament ready, and we weren't. And again, that was, again, huge help from Eddie as well, from European Tour, to get us to that standard. And also, you know, what the punters and what the pros have is very, very different.
Right. Interesting. I do have another question for you, Angus. Forgive me for this. When we met a couple of years ago, you told me you left school without any qualifications, you know, and you went greenkeeping because you didn't. So sorry for outing you there, but you said it to a journalist, so it's your own fault. You left without any qualifications. Is it still possible for a greenkeeper to progress throughout the careers if they maybe have fallen out of, maybe they're not academically sound, maybe the qualifications isn't their thing? Is it still possible for somebody to do what you did
Absolutely.
In the modern world?
Absolutely. I think you've got to get yourself out of your comfort zone. You've got to take risks. You have to believe in your own ability. You have to question yourself. Given the opportunity of running the Belfry is a dream, and then obviously running a European Tour event again was another dream. You know, so I'm reaching a goal of 54 now. And I'm thinking, you know, what else have I got to offer? But I think I'm happy with what I've achieved in my career, and you know, I got into greenkeeping by accident, and it's too good an industry to get into it by accident, you know. And I was saying to Eddie, you know, we were having obviously with a lot of downtime, there was a lot of watching the weather, so a lot of chatting about, you know, and hard work for me trumped talent, you know. It's just hard work and aspiring and if you get the opportunity to do any training, then jump at it, you know, knock your course manager's door and your head greenkeeper door down to get opportunities to train and develop the team, and that'll give them confidence. And you know, you're gonna lose your team. We spend probably most of the hotel's budget on training and development for the team. And I know I'm gonna lose them. And I know I'm gonna lose them in a year or 18 months, but that's reality. But I would, you know, so that's what they need to do. They need to be getting yourself out there and getting as much experience as you possibly can in different venues, you know, links courses and Heathland courses and Parkland courses, and there wasn't any opportunities for me when I was a 10 to 15 year old for, you know, and going out to the US and doing a scholarship program. There was nothing like that. But you know, the golf club believed in me, they gave me an opportunity, they put me through college at their expense, you know, and I wasn't gonna let them down, you know. So I gave them a bit of payback. So I went back to uni I think I was 39 to do my HN down at Pencoy University. It wasn't a university then. I probably didn't need to. I was a course manager already, but I felt I needed more qualifications, and HN was part of this, was mandatory for this role, you know. So there are just believe in yourself and you know what, and have a go, just have a punt, you know. I would rather fail miserably than not have a go at something, you know.
Funny enough, thanks Angus, that's great. What a great answer that was. That's fantastic. Jim, I'm going to come to you. You've done a Ryder Cup, MBA at the end of your name, you've achieved everything there is to achieve in the industry, and yet I see you on social media, you know, talking about what the team are doing, some of the things you're particularly proud of. What's the important, you know, the simple question is, you know, why do you take the time to do that? Why do you take the time to communicate on social media? It's something you don't have to do. Why do you want to, I suppose, do that?
Well, I think you're only as good as your team. It doesn't matter how good you are. It doesn't matter how good you think you are. You're only as good as the people you have around you. And, you know, these are the guys who produce. We are just responsible for leading the team or keeping it together, or as Angus and I often say, you know, our job is to direct the traffic, and these guys are the guys who actually, you know, drive and deliver the product or the tournament or whatever. And I think that's why, you know, I think you know I've said, you know, many times, particularly in the Bega magazines just after the Ryder Cup, that there was times where I just stood back in awe at what the guys were achieving. And I think that's the case for every single event that I've been involved in. I've always taken time to stand back. It might be during setup, and it might be during nighttime setup, but to take a step back and look at what the guys are doing, look at what they're achieving. And they deserve it, because you know they work long hours. It may be, as Angus said, an industry that they've got into by accident. And to be honest, I don't know too many people who have got into this job, that have got into greenkeeping because they wanted to be a greenkeeper. I've very rarely come across anybody who said, oh yeah, I said to the careers officer when I was 16, I want to be a greenkeeper. Because the careers officer probably said, what the hell's a greenkeeper? We've all got into it in different sort of ways. And, you know, I think these guys, they deserve that respect, and they've earned that respect. And, you know, and morally, it's just the right thing to do, I feel.
Good man. Thank you. Well said. Again, well said. Eddie, I'm going to come to you. This is a question from a bit from left field. When we actually met at Wentworth last year, it was you told me that Walter had passed away. Walter Woods, great Walter Woods.
Yeah.
You worked closely with him. I just wanted to take this opportunity while I've got you on camera. What was it that made Walter so special? What made him such an influence?
I'll probably get a bit bunged up thinking about him, but he was a straight talker, mm-hmm. pretty direct. He had a good sense of humour. He would call a spade a spade. I was lucky enough to work with him for 10 years and stayed a close friend after he retired from St Andrews, but then he joined the tour and did a similar job to what I was doing when I joined, along with Jack McMillan. So I lucked out there with two guys that were pretty influential in kind of how I kind of approach my kind of way. You know, I push quite hard. I'm a bit of a taskmaster when I was at St Andrews. I'll say that quite openly. The guys that I worked with probably have a giggle. I'm not one for handing out too many compliments. Walter wasn't either. But yeah, he was a strong individual, great friend, and sadly missed.
Good man. Well said. Thank you for that. I suppose we should finish and just say, Eddie, the UK swing, in your mind, was it a success? Was it?
Yeah, absolutely successful. You know, Jim had a good, solid working relationship with Graham McNiven. Eugene Hennessy got on well with Rob at the Forest of Arden. And the three guys I worked with, Brian Clark, Stan at Hanbury Manor, Stan Power, and obviously Angus, going well as well. And a credit to the industry, as I said, to the guys after the event. So all good with us, very delighted with the end result. And I think hopefully we'll get something patched up together next year, maybe, and see what happens.
Excellent. Okay, well, thank you very much, gents. I've kept you for an hour. Jim, I've kept you away from the Kennedys and your boat trip for an hour, so we'll let you go off. Sammy's just reappeared on the screen. Angus as well. Thank you very much from me for your time. Eddie, thank you. Sorry about any awkward questions or anything. Really fantastic to hear from you guys. It's been brilliant. I'm going to pass over to Sammy now, who's going to wrap things up for us. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Carl. Cheers.
Thanks, Carl.
Thanks, everybody. I hope that you've enjoyed that as much as I have. Some great quotes in there, Carl, for future use for bigger publications. I really hope that everybody has enjoyed today's webinar. Thank you all for joining us. We look forward to welcoming you back again soon. And I would just like to reiterate my thanks to Eddie, Jim and Angus for joining us today, and Carl for being our host. We'll see you all next time. Thank you.
Thanks, Sammy.
Thanks, guys. Thank you very much.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.